Fox, Lord Marshall, and editor of PrescientSciFi.com. For this episode 35, I wanted to talk about Motley Crue's and why we love them. I am not talking about the hair band from the 80s, talking about those lovable groups of criminals, pirates, mercenaries, those ragtag rejects that just steal our hearts and just go on to untold success on movies and television and sometimes in novels. You've seen them all over the place. Comic book movies, science fiction, and fantasy love them the most. They are the anti-heroes. They are the freaks, the weirdos, the rejected. They are the agents of disorder. They are against the man. They are always, they're ugly, they're untrimmed, they're unrefined. Sometimes they're just bad. But for some reason, we just take a liking to that kind of storyline, that kind of person, that just kind of group of characters. We seem to love these kind of characters. So I figured I'd spend a little time to talk about them for this episode. The kind of what brought it along is I've been watching the show Dark Matter. I don't know if any of you haven't seen it yet. It's a pretty good kind of space opera on Sci-Fi. I think it's a Canadian science fiction show on Sci-Fi, on the Sci-Fi channel. It's basically about a group of six people that wake up out of stasis pods on a spaceship, and they have no memory of who they are. It's a kind of a retrograde amnesia where they can speak, they know things about the ship, and about, you know, some of them have combat skills, but they have no idea how they learn them and whatever, but they just, so it's not like a total mind wipe. They're not, you know, infants. It's the fun kind of amnesia, in other words. So these six people wake up, they're on a ship full of mysteries, and they find out that they're basically a group of criminals that and mercenaries that work for hire and have very dark, twisted histories of murder, assassination, theft, intimidation, brutality, and whatnot. And the show is reasonably successful, I guess, for a cable show, and is starting to build a fan base. But it kind of reminded me of some of these other shows that and some of these movies over the last few years that kind of include this kind of cast of characters and this kind of storyline. The best term I kind of found for it was a Motley Crue. That's kind of the, I was trying to find the best word for it because some of the other words just don't quite fit this broad, like I wanted it a broader category. So anyway, according to Wikipedia, which is basically where I go for all knowledge, a Motley Crue is an informal expression for a roughly organized assembly of characters of various backgrounds, appearance, and character. Typical examples of Motley Crues are pirates, college fraternities, western posses, mercenary bands, and freedom fighters. They may align with, include, or be either the protagonist or the antagonist of the story. From all that, basically, they're just a group of bad people, and they often are at the center, and they can include the protagonist, if there is one, or it could be, you know, they could be the villains. Not so much, I don't know how common that is. I know that's in the definition, but just to go a little further here, Motley Crues are, by definition, non-uniform and undisciplined as a whole. They are typified by containing characters of conflicting personality, varied backgrounds, and usually, to the benefit of the group, a wide array of methods for overcoming adversity. And Dark Matter is like the one that kind of got me thinking about this, but like there's a lot of other big ones if you just think off the top of your head, especially in science fiction and fantasy. It's kind of like one of these favorite ways of showing rebellion and dissent, and also just in America, at least, us Americans, we have kind of an affinity for that kind of person, that kind of criminal and kind of anti-establishment mentality. So I'll get into that later. The other thing I'm using is kind of part of what I'm focused on is a lot of these Motley Crues are kind of like they're set up as an ensemble cast on movies and on television. What that means is basically there's a whole group. The story is about a group of them. It's not about one hero and then the crew behind them. It's usually all the actors or all the key characters get about roughly equal amounts of screen time or importance. And if it's a TV show, like each one gets like an up couple episodes where they're the key main character, and then another player becomes the main character in a few other episodes. And so by the end of the season, you get kind of a rough balance, but each individual episode is usually unbalanced and favored towards one or two of the key, the crew members are the most important. So, and that's how Dark Matter works, typically. Dark Matter usually picks one and kind of centers on them for an episode, and then it moves on to a next one. Or sometimes it'll center on a relationship between two of them. But I'm talking like mostly like there, and there are some shows where like the hero, like the Motley Crue, is just the secondary characters around them, you know, and there's one hero. The classic examples like Jason and the Argonauts, you know, basically Jason is the hero. The Argonauts are just a bunch of, I mean, some of them have names, but they're mostly like just nameless servants and things like that. We love the like Motley Crue and stuff, but the ensemble, like the general like kind of shows about groups rather than individuals. It's kind of like it's a basic form of interaction. If you think about like all drama, all movies, like if you think about it, they're all about the basic forms of human interaction. And the ones that most of us can recognize right away. We don't need to be experts at human, at psychology. We don't need to be dramatists. We don't need to be English majors. So here's, for example, like a lot of regular TV's dramas are about family, the interaction of parents with kids, kids with, you know, siblings with each other, siblings with their parents, aunts and uncles, grandparents. A lot of like made for TV movies, TV dramas, families. I mean, it's basically a whole genre of television. A lot of movies are basically about family and the interaction within a family unit. There's, of course, you know, friendship, the stories of two people developing a bond of friendship, or maybe even three people. There's obviously the romantic connection between two characters, you know, love. There's you know, the family unit. There's the 1-to-1, 2-to-1 kind of connections. There's not a whole lot about, you know, kind of commercial enterprises. The only time that you would see any other kind of organization is perhaps the tribe. But the tribe gets to be too big, because tribes, you know, usually it's multiple families. There's a lot of characters. Some kind of sagas and epics do kind of tribal things. I think, in my opinion, Walking Dead is about a tribe. It's also an ensemble cast, although Rick Grimes kind of probably gets a little bit more than everyone else. So those are all the kind of different basic human interactions that are portrayed in movies and TV drama. All our storytelling that centers around that usually centers around one of those basic core human interactions. And one of the ones that that is also very popular, and the one that's relevant to what I'm talking about, is the collective, the group dynamic. It is a group of people that come together for a common cause or a common objective, voluntarily usually, although not always. And the way they work as a group, the group dynamic, the cohesion, the cooperation, you know, the strengths and weaknesses being used differently. Like, that's one of those things that a lot of us appreciate. And so when we see, and it's not always easy to portray, because group dynamic involves multiple relationships, and it involves kind of an ability to think in almost three-dimensional terms of your characters, because you have to think about all of them at once, and sometimes it just gets complicated. Two characters, it's easy to write, easy to put together. Three characters starts to get a little dicey, but most Motley Crues or ensemble casts are four or more, and so just the dynamic gets more complicated, and the problem comes is when they get kind of bogged down in trying to show every single kind of part of it, when instead of the full kind of story. But that's in later. So anyway, so this kind of thing, it's usually four or more. I think if it's under four, it's not really a motley crew. It's not really a crew or an ensemble cast. Usually if you want to show like a motley crew or in this kind of thing, you see like unique personalities. Like, they're very a diverse group of people, different shapes and sizes, different skill sets, sometimes different motivations, kind of objectives, and sometimes they clash with each other. And so, like, one of the things they like to show in these things is how these groups that probably shouldn't work on the surface do work, how, like, the group deals with dissent and deals with disagreements and things like that. But ultimately, in order to call them a crew or a group or any kind of collective, they have to have a common goal. And usually in storytelling, the common goal is a positive goal. For kind of criminal groups, usually they want to do good things, but they do bad things to do. It's like an ends justify the means kind of thing, where their ultimate goal is good and positive, even though they're considered criminals and anti-heroes. But ultimately, what they want to do is good. They just kind of do it in a less than legal way. you know, usually breaks the rules, breaks the laws. Sometimes what they do is criminal and does hurt people, but usually the people they hurt, you know, the audience is made to think they deserved it, or it's not really a crime to do it. And also, just as a general notion of why we group together and why we form crews or collectives or societies, is the idea that we're stronger together than we are individually. And you see that kind of, because usually these crews, like each individual of them, is pretty worthless by themselves. They're just not, they're antisocial, they're rejects, they're criminal, they don't do well on their own. But for some reason, you put them together, it's like a chemical reaction with the right group of people, and they begin to be stronger, more effective, and they seem to get things done, and they surprise and shock people at their effectiveness. And that's what Dark Matter shows, the TV show Dark Matter. These people by themselves are just killers, but together, and they work for money. I mean, they don't really, they're just mercenaries, but together they do these amazing things together because they combine their skills, and then they have a unique ship, and et cetera. So that was the example I was thinking of. Now, I'm talking about like the criminal side of it, the anti-heroes, the dark side, if you will. But on the other side, we've also seen some positive ensemble casts, like Star Trek is the most obvious. They're not criminals. They're not mercenaries, pirates, or whatever. They're all well-trained. They're basically all graduate students that are put on a ship together. They learn how to coalesce with each other, and they do great things because they're all just well-adjusted, great people. And to see them work and do big things is amazing. It's aspirational. So Star Trek is like one of those weird exceptions where they show they show a positive, well-formed, you know, well-run, you know, ordered group. And there's not too many of those examples in the American tradition. I really, honestly, in science fiction, Star Trek is the only one I can think of. I know military science fiction probably has a lot of examples of military units that are fighting for a noble cause of victory, you know, protecting their species, to protecting the innocent from some evil aggressor. But off the top of my head, all I can think of is Star Trek for like kind of like the positive crew. We kind of, in America at least, I can't speak to other countries, I can only speak about my own, but I think I know Americans just have like this affinity for the antisocial, the anti-establishment, the anti-hero. What history sometimes are kind of like what the society refers to as the lowlifes. And there's some big examples here as proof of that. And one of them is we have an affinity for criminals, a certain kind of criminal. We kind of empathize or even idolize them sometimes, even though they're mostly monsters. And the example of that is the movie The Godfather, which arguably is the greatest movie ever made. I think critics, I mean, there's just like a consensus that Godfather is one of the best. It's about a mafia family that kill people. They kill each other. They kill kind of rivals. It's killers killing other killers. So you kind of don't feel that bad about it because the targets of their violence are not, you know, sympathetic characters. But The Godfather is about a whole family working outside of American society. They don't live by the rules. They do everything their own way. They don't really try to... And actually, the only character that's interested in trying to assimilate and integrate into American society is Michael Corleone, and Vito, to some extent. And they find their efforts frustrated by racism and bigotry within the mainstream American culture at the time, which is anti-Italian and whatnot. So the only way they can do things for their family is to act outside the law. And we kind of we end up kind of sympathizing with their plight, you know, with the plight of immigrants and dealing with an authority in a mainstream society that is against us. For whatever reason, I mean, our country was founded on rebelling against the man, in this case, King George III. So we love we have an affinity for those stories, the stories of the underdog, the stories of the mutt, the redheaded stepchild, the reject, you know, the Rocky Balboas, you know, the ones that aren't supposed to, like, from the way they sound, the way they dress, the way, you know, their background, they don't have the right degrees. They're not supposed to succeed, and they're not supposed to reach any kind of levels of success in the order, and they break that order. And The Godfather is kind of a celebration of people that, a celebration of individuals finding ways to do to serve their family and to serve their people in defiance of the order, despite all the obstacles put in front of them. Now, in the end, the Godfather saga is a tragedy. If you don't believe me, watch the third movie again. And there's a lot of things that happen in The Godfather that are straight-up crimes, that are innocent people getting hurt. I mean, they do sell drugs. They do, some of their families and some of their peons do terrible things to people that don't deserve it. And then, of course, there's the racketeering, the intimidation of honest business people in the Italian-American community. So, and yet, you know, that story just strikes a nerve with us and has ever since that movie premiered. Another example is pirates. Americans love pirates. I love pirates. And if you don't believe me, just the success of the movie, The Pirates of the Caribbean, and the whole three movies, they're awesome movies. And we just have this thing about pirates, about privateering, about just going out on your own with your own damn ship and doing things, not listening to any corporation or any authority of any kind. You're just out there on your own, stealing, and usually you're stealing from the government, or from, you know, in the case of these movies, a lot of times it's these wealthy corporations in East India Trading Company, but of course they're also robbing and killing regular, you know, honest merchants and seamen. So there's that too. But for whatever reason, we just kind of like the idea of the pirate. It's a kind of the life without attachment. And so that's another kind of thing that we have a thing. And also the anti-hero, the kind of guy that he's going through his life just trying to make a living. He doesn't want to live by any rules, and so he goes out and becomes like the Han Solo. But deep inside, they're actually decent human beings. They don't really want to hurt anyone. It's almost like a Robin Hood complex. They steal from the rich and keep some for themselves. They just don't give it to the poor. And yet somehow when they're given an opportunity to rise up and join a cause on their own terms, voluntarily, they rise. And Han Solo did that in Star Wars Episode 4. And he ended up becoming a key figure in the rebellion, which, you know, at the beginning of all three movies, he wanted nothing to do with them. He thought they were all nuts, but he found something in it and became a better person, at least for a while. So those are the three like kind of big ones I wanted to say that are kind of like evidence that, like, at least in America, we just have this love of the rejects. And those are like three big examples. And now I want to turn to like the more recent examples of especially in my genre in science fiction. I already mentioned Dark Matter, and that's the one I'll talk about first, because that's the one I've been watching lately. Season 2 is about to end. Like I said, it's a good show, maybe not the greatest show. It's done on a budget, so there might be some things in there that hardcore science fiction fans will kind of point to and raise the red flags, like, hey, that's not realistic, oh, that's silly, or maybe things that kind of look cheesy and kind of underdone. Well, I mean, the show's done on a budget, so, you know, maybe just cut them some slack. They don't have James Cameron's budget, or The Walking Dead's budget, for that matter. The cast is interesting. I think that's the thing they try to sell you on. It's not the special effects, it's not the world building, because none of that's all that impressive. It's these six characters that have their minds wiped. Now, before they had their memories wiped, they were terrible people. Most of them, not all of them. Four of them were just straight up killers, mercenaries. They had no morals, they were deeply flawed people with very dark pasts, and they did terrible things. One of them was a street urchin, a young girl, like 16, 17. And then one of them was a cop acting undercover, trying to capture them, get them arrested. So it's a group of six. And since they don't know their names, they call themselves by the order in which they woke up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Which I thought was a cool little innovation. So instead of calling each other by name on the crew, even after they learn their names, their real names, they still call each other by number, like 3, 5, hey, 4 is, you know, 4 is stuck in the airlock, or 2 is on the bridge. They still call each other by number because of their shared experience of not knowing anything. And the weird thing is, as they advance without these memories, and some of these memories are very painful, they actually evolve into pretty decent people, and they learn to kind of develop a bond with each other that before was just about money and self-interest, and, you know, they'd cut each other's throat if it was in their interest. But as the show reaches season two, they develop this actual genuine, affinity for one another. And it's a little bit cheesy and hokey, but whatever. I think that part of it is interesting. They develop genuine bonds with each other, and they actually form a new kind of crew that is that actually just no longer wants to go back to their past and reclaim their memories and reclaim their what they were. They want to be something else, and it's a very cool little psychological thing of what happens if. It's kind of like saying that a lot of what makes people cruel and angry and miserable is their past, painful memories, trauma, abuse. And if you take that away in the form of amnesia, these same people who most people would figure are psychopaths actually have an opportunity to develop into well-adjusted and actually good people if you take away that pain. It's an interesting idea. It's been explored before, but like in this case, it's a memory wipe. And even when they learn about their past, they reject it because it's just facts to them. They don't remember experiencing it. So I thought that was a cool little angle. And you see kind of them develop bonds with each other because they're kind of experiencing the world the same way as people with amnesia, whatever you call that. So that's on Sci-Fi. That's a pretty good show. Very good looking cast, by the way. I mean, I wouldn't call them the best group of actors and the most compelling dramatic actors, but they are some good looking people. Two in particular, who I believe is played by an actress named Melissa O'Neill. Let me pull it up real quick. I want to give their names. Okay, Melissa O'Neill plays Two, who is basically the captain, the leader. She is she's a badass for sure. Kind of a generic strong female character, but she drives a lot of the plot because of her. She's the commander, and also she kind of gets things done. Anthony Lemke as Three, or Marcus Boone. He's kind of like that. Gun fanatic. He's the more loose cannon. He's the one that's more naturally the piece of shit. The rest of them kind of develop some moral compass or direction or some kind of ethics. He's the only one that doesn't right away. It takes him a whole season before he starts to. And even then, it gradually comes to the surface. He's a smart ass. He talks a lot of game, but he seems to just kind of have a lot of patience despite, kind of his tough guy exterior. Not really, like, it's not the best, it's not done, like, all that great, but I think he does a pretty cool job. Alex Mallari Jr. as Four, or Ryo Tetsuda. He plays, like, a stoic kind of samurai-type character, and there's also Jadel Furland, who plays Five, or Emily Colburn. She is the young one. She's the street urchin that kind of sneaks onto the ship as a stowaway. She's like 16 or 17 years old. The rest of them are in their 20s and 30s. She's kind of like the heart and soul of the ship. She's kind of like Kaylee from Firefly. She's the one that has like she's the purest of heart. She's the most naive, the most innocent. And she's the one that kind of believes in the rest of them kind of rejecting their past. And so her facial reactions, like, she doesn't emote that much, and she kind of speaks kind of deadpan sometimes, but she's kind of like I don't want to say mascot of the crew, because she does develop, it turns out she's very useful, and saves their ass a few times. There's also Zoe Palmer plays the android, who is a humanoid, android, for the ship, basically an AI. And of course, as an AI, she starts developing human tendencies because every science fiction show has to do that for some reason. So those are some big highlights. There's the rest of them, I guess, are kind of, they're okay. They're just, but yeah, I just wanted to give a couple of those names out there. But here's some other big ones that you probably have heard of. I'd already mentioned Firefly. Firefly is like probably one of the best Motley crews I've ever seen. Their chemistry, their setup, their the way they speak, I mean, the way they work with each other. As I said, Kaylee is the engineer, the mechanic, and she is the innocent, naive heart of the crew. You have Mal Reynolds, who's Nathan Fillion, who's like an amazing captain, both strong, but also just has this playful side to him that I think only Nathan Fillion could have done. Then, of course, Zoe and Wash. Zoe being the second in command, also a soldier. Wash is the pilot. Jane is basically the three of three plays Jane's role in Dark Matter. Basically, they're the ones that are the most morally compromised, the most likely to do bad things for self-interest. They're not cruel or malicious, but they look out for number one first, and a lot of times show that kind of side of them more than anyone else. And the rest of the crew kind of tolerates it, but kind of keeps him in check so that he doesn't become the monster he could be. Then, of course, you have the Thames, River, and Simon. And, of course, Inara, who's a wild card, the companion, who is the love interest of Mal, but also kind of the sophisticated one of the group. And that's kind of like a unique thing in Firefly. Dark Matter doesn't really have that. None of the six are that sophisticated. They're all kind of not very well educated, not very talented or skillful, until number one finds out who he is, and then he starts to emerge as that type of person. But Inara is, in the universe of Firefly, a companion or an escort, but in that society, they're held in high regard. She's highly educated. She's trained in social norms and etiquette and all these other things, in addition to just being good in bed. She's expected to kind of serve as a consort in all sorts of ways, not just a whore. So that was kind of like a unique throw in there. And then just the dynamic, the way they are with each other, you get the feeling that these characters and the way they're portrayed by the actors, that they genuinely like each other and want to be around each other. So Firefly, and also the broader kind of theme of independence. You know, they have their own ship. They're basically pirates. Kind of this rugged individualism. They don't want any government or anyone telling them what to do. They hate bureaucracy, so they only work with other criminals. But in the end, they don't really try to hurt little people. They want to steal from rich and give to the poor, basically. But they also, just the broader theme is that they feel like people are happier and people are better off when they don't have Big Brother standing over them. Guardians of the Galaxy. Big, big, big one. That movie was about the formation of a motley crew, because they're not a crew to start off with. The only grouping is Raccoon and Groot. And they have kind of a similar structure. They have kind of a strong leader, in a sense, in Star-Lord. But they also have... they have Groot. Groot basically is like the lovable, kind of innocent one that's not involved in the psychological baggage. He's kind of like the Kaylee or the Five of the other shows. And of course, and all he says is, "I am Groot." And the only person that seems to understand what he means is Raccoon. And then you have Dax and Gamora and they form like this really bizarre group of people, and they, just through self-interest and just being thrown through this extreme situation, they all decide to kind of unite to destroy this threat to the universe, and they decide they actually kind of like each other and have affinity for each other. And Groot's all right, spoiler. Spoiler alert. 3, 2, 1. Groot's sacrifice at the end of the movie is what really pulls everything together, and he kind of declares them a crew at the end. It's a very beautiful moment, by the way. And the movie is awesome. I mean, the special effects, the acting. Chris Pratt is awesome. I mean, him and Nathan Fillion, I mean, they're like perfect leading people. Zoe Saldana, I'll watch her in any movie. And, Bradley Cooper as Raccoon. I mean, it was all... And just to include a CGI Raccoon as one of your characters was pretty cool. And of course, a talking tree. So the diversity in that group and the way they interact, kind of the banter and how funny they are with each other. I mean, it's an awesome movie, and I can't wait for the second one. The Avengers is a kind of a unique motley crew, because some of them are very talented and actually part of the Order, and the rest of them are not. But they all kind of come together, uniting behind the common cause. And they're all heroes in their own movies, but their common cause is to save the world, same as Guardians of the Galaxy. So they're So kind of like for them, uniting is kind of like they have no choice. And I guess maybe that takes a little bit away from it, in that their common cause and what binds them to begin with is something that, you know, it's either we do this or we die. So you don't really get that kind of genuine voluntary unification into a group. But at the same time, you know, they all individually are heroes. All individually, they're very effective people, and they do great things by themselves, and they have to find a way to share the spotlight. And it's kind of like just how they are in real life. I mean, Chris Evans, Robert Downey Jr., Chris Helmsworth, or Liam, or I don't know, whichever one it is, one of the Helmsworths. I mean, these are all kind of stars in their own right, and they have to learn to share the spotlight. So in a way, the characters and the actors are doing the same thing on screen. It's a very cool little bit, and they kind of, I think they have some fun with it. There's some kind of self-deprecating and some borderline fourth wall breaking moments. I think Avengers also benefited from all the crew members, in this case, or team members, being known quantities. They'd all had their own movie already. And you just introduced a couple new ones, you know, their chemistry with each other, they're great actors, and they ended up coming together in a very strong way in the first one. Age of Ultron, I think, is kind of a rehash of a lot of the things that happen in the first movie. It's just a different enemy, so it's not, and also it's crazier. The second movie's a little bit crazier, and you get kind of, I had a hard time keeping my feet on the ground, so to speak, watching that one. But still an excellent movie, just maybe not as good as the first one. But both of them are very cool, very, very well worth watching. And you do see kind of the chemistry that develops between the individual characters, and then when they finally coalesce as a group towards the end. The Justice League is... in the Batman versus Superman movie, I mean, that's they're trying to do the same thing, but in a very, very different way. First off, there's only one member of this new team that has a precursor movie, and that's Superman, Man of Steel. The Ben Affleck Batman is an unknown quantity, although we all know Batman. This Wonder Woman, this is the first time Wonder Woman's been depicted on a major movie in decades. And spoiler alert, in 3, 2, 1, the other members of the team are not even in the movie. They're in images and videos shown in the movie. So we don't get to see Aquaman, Cyborg, and the Flash. We only see the first three members of the group. And oh, by the way, only two of them interact with each other to any degree, and that's Batman and Superman. And the way they interact is not in a team-building exercise. They're trying to kill each other. Wonder Woman shows up in a very awesome scene to save Batman's ass. But she hardly interacts with Batman or Superman at all in the movie. It's maybe three or four lines, and it's in an adversarial fashion. So these three founding members are adversaries in this movie. And again, they unite because this to save the planet. That's the only reason they really unite. Otherwise, Wonder Woman was basically going to go back into hiding. She was in the hiding this whole time. She had no intention of becoming a superhero. She just wanted to just go about what she did. Superman and Batman had very different interests. And by the end of the movie, they're not a team. They're just not. It's called The Dawn of Justice, but really what this movie does is it shows kind of Act 1 of Avengers. Basically, Act 1 and Act 2 of the Avenger movie without the Act 3, where they actually form the team. That is for the Justice League movie, which comes out next year. So I think in that sense, that movie didn't, in terms of narration, in terms of building this new crew, this motley crew, The Dawn of Justice didn't do that. But it kind of told you, that's what we're going to do in the next movie. That's what it's telling you. And so I think that's kind of, I mean, the Justice League is supposed to be an ensemble and a motley crew, just like the Avengers, and they're just doing it in a very weird way, in a very slow, methodical, almost backwards kind of way. And it made a lot of money, but the reviews and the customer and the fan reaction was mixed. But I think everyone wanted to see that movie once, and that's why, and also throughout the world, and that's why it made about $850 million. But I don't know if I don't really know if it really, if everyone's going to give the next one that same kind of, well, I need to see it kind of attitude. X-Men is obviously an ensemble cast and a motley crew because mutants are freaks. And these are all freaks that have been persecuted when throughout their whole lives. And then now they have to go to a school and then learn to interact with each other socially and where they're not being treated as freaks and whatever. And then the most mature, most developed ones become part of the X-Men team, the actual combatants that fight Magneto or fight whoever, Apocalypse or whoever. They're intentionally recruited. Professor Xavier is trying to build the team consciously, trying to get them to volunteer, but he's building a team with a plan in mind, and he's looking for the right kind of recruits. That's kind of what's kind of a little unique about X-Men. Firefly, there is some recruiting taking place, but it's mostly ad hoc. I mean, Jane joins the crew after they, you know, at Jane and his, you know, group have them at gunpoint, and Mal and Zoe offer him a job. And that's the only reason he joins the crew. Kaylee joins the crew after their first mechanic or engineer is a douche. She was actually having sex with the first mechanic, and Mal came down there to ask him if he'd gotten the drive done yet, and he's like, well, it's too hard, and actually turns out Kaylee knew how to fix it, and the engineer didn't, so he hires Kaylee on the spot, even though the only reason she was there is that she was trying to hook up with the first engineer, but it's kind of this weird little thing. The TAMs are on there, they're paid. Inara, it's a kind of financial arrangement. But so it's not consciously recruited. That kind of that group just kind of came together. Guardians of the Galaxy, they just came together. The Avengers, Fury is trying to pull them together, and so is Agent. I'm blanking on his name. The agent that's in all the movies of S.H.I.E.L.D. God, it's gonna kill me. One that kids will know, and I think Star Wars fans, because I talked a little of Star Trek, some of these other sci-fi fans, I got to talk about Star Wars, and I got to talk about Star Wars Rebels on Disney XD. The show starts off with a group of rebel, it's a rebel cell, but they basically just steal from the Empire, and it's Kanan Jarrus, who is a former Jedi Padawan who escaped Order 66. He has some of the skills, but he does not show them, and he is not on the Jedi path. He's just basically a kind of pirate and whatever. He's joined by Hera Syndulla, who is the pilot, and I think it's a Twi'lek. I think I have the species right. And then they also recruit a Mandalorian teenager by the name of Sabine, and then a Lassat by the name of Zeb. And then the four of them, and then they have the asteroid droid named Chopper. They have to have a droid. It's always a cool little addition. It's kind of like, it's their version of R2-D2 or BB-8, and Chopper's kind of more of a pain in the ass than helpful. So I thought that was like a cool little switch they did. Like, R2-D2 is extremely useful, and just everyone likes him. There's nothing not to like about R2-D2. Same thing with BB-8. Everyone loves BB-8. If you don't love BB-8, there's something wrong with you. I mean, and he's useful. Chopper is not always useful. In fact, he's often the cause of problems. And he's also kind of a jerk. So he was kind of a cool little innovation. The four members of the crew are all kind of loosely built. I mean, it's a kid's show. It's a cartoon. So you're not going to go into too much depth, and you can't really give too much subtlety and nuance to their relationship. But you kind of see why they're a crew. They all hate the Empire, and they all want to hurt the Empire, but they're not vicious people. And but they're also not idealistic to think they're going to win in a rebellion. They just want to live their life kind of stealing from the rich and giving to the poor and that kind of thing. They are recruited. I mean, Hera obviously has bigger dreams of for being part of a broader rebellion, but the other ones are not so much. And Ezra Bridger, who's the last edition and kind of the final edition, and that's what Sparks of Rebellion, the first episode, is about, is the discovery of Ezra Bridger, a force-sensitive teenager who also has a bone to pick with the Empire and also has some abandonment issues and some issues with anger, kind of like Anakin Skywalker. Kanan decides to train him. Jedi have this weird way of accepting recruits and accepting Padawan learners who clearly probably should not be trained because of the dangers of them turning. They have issues. just like Anakin did, and Anakin, obviously, you know, hindsight, should not have been trained. Ezra, we're only two seasons in, and so far we're showing, for the most part, he's been a good student. He's struggled, he's frustrated, he has some anger, and he's gotten over some of his issues with his parents, as cartoons can show it. But you can definitely see in him this desire for power, to destroy and to protect, and he has attachments, which is what ultimately brought Anakin down. But, I mean, they're, most of them probably started off as just wanting to do a little bit of this and that to make a living. And then, by season two, they are part of a bigger fight. One final example that's kind of outside of outside of science fiction, but kind of has that kind of feel to it, is Lord of the Rings. Which is not a perfect example for a few reasons. One, the group, the crew doesn't stay together for more than a movie. And they kind of splinter off into three subgroups. You have Merry and Pippin, you have Frodo and Sam, and then you have Legolas, Gimli, and Aragorn. So they're not really, they don't unite as a crew, but they call themselves a fellowship. And even though they're separated by distance, they remain united in their ultimate cause, but they have to do it independently. But they're about a group, basically, and Gandalf at the head. So that's, I mean, it's kind of a weird example. Also, you also have in The Hobbit, you have the dwarves and Bilbo. The only real thing about these movies is Lord of the Rings is a lot of it's about Frodo. And usually in these kind of ensemble casts, you're supposed to kind of balance screen time. And in this point, you kind of do, but it's usually split between Aragorn and Frodo. And then kind of everyone else gets second billing. And in The Hobbit, you get Bilbo Baggins gets the bulk of the screen time. And then Thorin Oakenshield gets the second most, and the rest of them are in the second and third. So they're not quite the same. So Lord of the Rings, I mean, they don't really fit very well, but it's kind of like fantasy's version of it. You will notice ensemble casts a lot in comedies too, though. Like How I Met Your Mother, although How I Met Your Mother does sometimes focus a little bit more on the narrator, but a lot of it is about all the different players, the league, Seinfeld. I mean, all of them kind of tilt towards the protagonist, but I mean, a lot of the screen time is shared. So comedy is one of those things, and comedies a lot of times are troops, like improv troops, like Kids in the Hall or things like that, or Monty Python. So they're used to wanting to balance screen time just for the fact that they came in as a group, and so they want to depict what's going on as a group, and they're not centered around one superstar. So comedy does it a lot, which is, I think it works out very well a lot of times, because when you start to like all of them, like how they work with each other and they work off each other, the chemistry and the jokes and everything, they learn to work off each other. And I think that's kind of what has to happen in action and cartoons and drama that use the group dynamic. They have to work off each other, and they have to, like, each of them, like 1 + 1 = 2 if they're all separate, but if as a group, it's like 1 + 1 = 4. That as a group, they're just exponentially more effective and stronger and smarter and just wiser and better people together than they would be as just constituent parts. All right, so last part of this is what makes for kind of a good Motley Crue, what makes for a bad one? Well, if you're gonna depict criminals, they have to actually be criminals. So you can't just say they are pirates or that they are bad people, and yet in the entire show, they do good things and they actually are good people. It's like, wait a minute, I thought they're supposed to be pirates. Why do they all seem to have such moral hang-ups about stealing? And I've seen this in shows, like even in the show Dark Matter. Dark Matter, it's about a memory wipe, so it's a little different, but you see them, they seem to have moral qualms about a lot of what they have to do. And it's like, well, look, you're trying to tell me that these people at their base, that they were once all criminals and all bad people. But what you're showing me is, like, and especially one, the character one, he is this whiny idealist. And I'm expected to believe that he was once a criminal or that he had the mentality of a criminal. Instead, it's like he has this built-in, you know, ethics that if you had your memory wiped, that really should not be there either. So that doesn't really work. So if you're going to show bad people, at some point they're going to have to do bad things or do things that show that they are not conformists, that they don't follow the law, that that they're, you know, they're a little antisocial. If shows can't show that, and Dark Matter does have a little bit of that issue, then you don't really buy into the fact that they really are, you know, a rough and tumble, undisciplined, conflicted, you know, whatever. So that would be my first one. But if they're not criminals, they're just, you know, like Star Wars rebels. I mean, they're basically Robin Hood. They're stealing from the rich, giving to the poor. They are idyllic, or they are idealists in some sense. So you don't need to see them do bad things because they're not depicted as bad people. Yes, they steal from the Empire, but they do it because they hate the Empire, not because they feel like things belong to them and they steal just because they're greedy. All right. So for any group, like for a successful like TV show, movie, or in science fiction, the characters have to be diverse. They cannot be homogenous. They cannot be similar. So they can't just be, you know, five or six soldiers with different names, or five or six pirates with different names, and maybe a couple different, you know, and maybe a couple gender switches. They need their personalities, their speaking styles, their bios, their motivations, their interests. It has to vary. Their appearance, you know, it helps if their appearance varies, if their names vary, if their cultural backgrounds vary. That helps. They don't need to be, it doesn't need to be tokens where every single one of them is completely different from the other, because then you lose some of that. Well, then why are they a group? Why do they work well together if they're so different? So avoid homogeny, but that doesn't mean it needs to be total heterogeneity, to borrow a term. If it's about a group, then eventually over the course of a season or whatever, all the characters have to be developed equally, because then you get that feel that this is a group, and then you start to love the connections between each of them and the cross connections and the dynamics and the chemistry. If it focuses on one or two of the main ones and the rest of them are supporting cast, you're going to lose a lot of that, because then you will automatically start treating the secondary characters as inferior, and everything will be seen through the guy. It's almost like a, you know, instead of a spider web of characters, you have a wagon wheel with one character in the middle and the rest. So you will only see the crew through the eyes of the protagonist. Trying to think of an example of that. The superhero ones where they have like a bunch of helpers, like the Flash, as I recall, has like three or four people helping him that are not superheroes. Smallville, with some of the characters that were helping Clark Kent. And, you know, Batman has Alfred and Lucius Fox. So if to do an ensemble cast, you balance out the screen time, and then you make the whole group, you make the whole cast the core, the protagonist, instead of just one person. And then it does depersonalize it to some extent, but then you also have the opportunity to kind of win over more people, because when people watch an ensemble cast, you can find somebody within that group that you can relate to. So if you can't relate to the, you know, Captain Kirk, you can find a way to relate to Sulu or Uhura or Spock or whatever. Everyone could find somebody on that crew they loved. And it's the same thing with Guardians of the Galaxy or Firefly. If you don't like the captain or the leader, you're going to find somebody else on that crew you really like, and you're going to see that favorite character have a prominent role in many parts of the show. So, but if you want to make it about your hero or about the protagonist, I mean, some shows do that and they succeed, but it's going to succeed or fail based on the power of that one character. Supporting cast isn't going to help you that much, no matter how interesting they are, because they don't get enough billing, they don't get enough screen time, and they don't affect the plot enough. Some shows and books have this problem. Introducing the characters all at once. Books do this all the time. TV shows sometimes do this, but I think when they have to do a pilot episode, they have no choice. They have to pack every character in. But doing all the introductions in one scene, very problematic. It's hard to keep track of who's who and what's what their names are. You can't tell them apart, so you need to develop them separately and individually. Novels have this tendency of basically doing a roll call. I've read this in a few books. They do a roll call of the whole unit, of all the characters in this group, and they describe each one of them by appearance, background, whatever, all in one chapter. Like, I'm going to remember that. Instead, demonstrate them to me and introduce them to me one by one. I'm more like readers are more likely to remember that because then they attach the character to a certain event or experience rather than it all happening at once in one chapter. A lot of, like, for example, there's a writer by the name of Alex Feinman. He has a article on this issue that he has a couple suggestions, so I'll post that on here. But he kind of suggested that if you're writing a story or whatever, like if you're building one of these things out there, be careful in naming the members of your crew and make sure that none of the names are too similar. He suggests giving them unique passions. You have to keep them as a collective. They have to have a common cause or a common purpose, so you can't sacrifice that, but you want to give them kind of maybe different passions as secondary or, you know, whatever, hobbies, pursuits, whatever. You know, if they weren't part of the crew, what would they be doing? Try to make that a little different. But largely, they kind of group the same way, like on TV and even in movies. There's always the one lovable, kind of like the child, the naive, the innocent, kind of like the heart, the superego, maybe, if you want to start using psychology terms. But they're the character that everyone likes and respects, but that character has no authority or no power. But they're always there to like be a guide and to kind of remind you of and kind of rein in some of the darker and nastier and even criminal elements. And the examples I would say is Groot from Guardians of the Galaxy. He's obviously just like them in a lot of ways, but he's like he has no power. He doesn't give orders. He doesn't want it. He doesn't have any ego whatsoever. He's always just reacting to what the others do, and occasionally he will suggest things and try to persuade them, but he doesn't have any power. Kaylee on Firefly, I mean, she has no authority, but she's always, you know, she has her say, and sometimes she does impact decisions by Mal and Wash and these others. Frodo in the Fellowship of the Ring, of course, he didn't really act as much of a... Yeah, I'm going to cross that one out. I had that listed here, but I don't think it really works. But I think the two top examples are Groot and Kaylee. And Dark Matter, it's number 5. In Star Wars Rebels, it's Hera, but Hera's basically in charge. So I don't know. I don't think that works. All right. But there's always that, you can always have that one kind of innocent, naive, you know, kind of the super ego. But in order for that character to work, they got to have no power. And they don't have any ego involved. They're selfless, and they're there to kind of push everyone around them morally, emotionally, and kind of that way instead of, you know, by physical force or by powers of persuasion, whatever. The leader, there's always like one strong leader. There's always like a head. There's usually one leader. It can usually be the strongest, the one that's the most talented, or the ones that, in terms of force and martial power or things like that. Guardians of the Galaxy does not really have that person, although Star-Lord is supposed to kind of be that person. Firefly, of course, has Mal, although Zoe is pretty formidable in her own right. X-Men, I mean, you're led to believe it's either Wolverine or Cyclops, but it's really Jean Grey or Phoenix. Star Wars Rebels, it's Kanan, largely. The Force wielder. Dark Matter, it's obviously Two, the Captain, or Porcelain. Star Trek, it's either Picard or Kirk, whatever. But anyway, you can have that strong leader that's kind of like the strongest, like either physically or martially, or has the most will. That doesn't mean they're the smartest, it doesn't mean they're the most effective, but it just means like they're the ones that can have the most raw ability. A lot of shows benefit from having a number two, a second in command that kind of is a supporter for the leader, but follows them. They usually don't give orders. Actually, Kanan for Star Wars Rebels kind of fulfills that role because he largely takes orders from Hera. In Dark Matter, it can be Three. Three listens to Two a lot, even though he's supposed to be kind of like this selfish greedy, you know, piece of shit. But he actually listens to two. And actually four, I mean, the rest of them listen to her. But three, in the end, largely does not disobey her and will follow her lead. And the rest of them do too. But he's also, he's the other elite gunman. And then four is also the martial artist, the samurai kind of. And so he also listens to her and kind of supports her position. In X-Men, Professor Xavier actually is technically the leader, and he has Cyclops as his number two, who's always backing him up. So actually, that's the one that makes sense. Avengers, there is no leader, really. I mean, it kind of varies. Firefly, it's Zoe, of course. Guardians of the Galaxy, it can either be Gamora or Raccoon that backs up Star-Lord, although that's not really clear. Star Trek, of course, it's either Commander Riker or Spock. It's the number two in command. It's always nice to include a wild card, one that normally would not fit in any other group anywhere else. They are like a solo person otherwise, and the only reason, for some weird reason, they fit in this motley crew. And the examples are Rocket Raccoon or Drax. Both of them should not fit on any crew ever. Jane on Firefly, he shouldn't fit on any crew. He's basically he does things for money. But otherwise, he's worthless. You would think he wouldn't follow anyone's orders or be of any help to any group. Zeb and Ezra are both wild cards to some extent, although I'd say Ezra on Star Wars Rebels. Wolverine is like the natural wild card. You know, hey, I don't want to join your little X-Men, you know, group, whatever. Murdoch on A-Team, who is literally insane, wild card. These kind of wild cards, they can be pretty or ugly. They can either kind of be an off-again, on-again supporter, or maybe the only person they listen to is the leader, and they listen to no one else, and they don't cooperate, and there's only one person on the planet they take orders from. So that kind of wild card is a good person to add in from time to time. By the way, some of these roles can, some characters can fulfill two of these roles at once, I think. I've already kind of made that mistake already in explaining this, so because I've already mentioned the same character doing two or three things. The wise old man is a common addition to stories. Sometimes they're the leader. Sometimes they're just there to once in a while, you know, impart wisdom. I think one of the archetypes of this is Merlin from King Arthur. But now we have Professor Xavier. We have Gandalf. We have the shepherd in Firefly. So we have, older, more intelligent, and they're usually men. That's just the way the tradition is up to today. That could change in the future. We could see some more stories where you see a wife. Actually, there probably are some stories with wise old women being the purveyor of wisdom. I guess maybe in the examples I've come up with, they're all men. Star Wars or science fiction just generally has been more of a men's club, unfortunately. Obi-Wan Kenobi, Yoda, Mace Windu, and now Luke Skywalker in the new one. I mean, these are all wise old men. And the stories themselves, I mean, some of these movies are just about the team, that they start off as just a bunch of individuals, and we actually get to witness their coalescing into a team. The Avengers and Guardians of the Galaxy are two key examples. The first season of Dark Matter is an example. They're not a team when you start, they're a team when you finish. And so you kind of see that coalescing. Justice League failed. Justice League just shows Act 1 and Act 2. It does not show the actual unification of the team. That is obviously the next movie. If you watch the trailers for Justice League, that's what they're going to do next. They did not do that in Dawn of Justice or in any of the movies. So kind of a weird thing they did there. So that's... The other thing is, if you already have a team or you already have a group, sometimes the entry character, you have a new character that is the point of view character, and they're the ones that join the crew, and it's from their point of view that you're introduced to them and you experience them and you integrate, and that character is integrated into the crew, and sometimes that's the first chapter or the first story or the first movie. Another thing is once you have this team together, in order to build that team building, that collective kind of unification and that connection to each other, they have to be tested through trials where they have to rely on one another. They have to succeed as a group over some threat, whether it's the end of the world or just a threat to their livelihoods or a threat to their lives individually. Maybe the world isn't going to end. Maybe they're just going to die. And but they each have to like contribute to surviving it in their own way. So you can't just have one person save the day. Otherwise, they're not really a team. They're just, you know, one hero and a bunch of supporting. So everyone has to like contribute something to the victory or the overcoming of the whatever the threat is. Another one neat little plot device you see every so often is you have an outsider try to tempt one of them into betraying the team, into leaving the team, into kind of convincing them that the team or the leader of the team is on the wrong path. And then you see how the unit, you know, how that individual, when it comes, push comes to shove, they kind of reaffirm their loyalty to the team. Or you see the, or you see maybe one individual on the team, you know, under threat, and the unit closes ranks and sacrifices their own health and safety, you know, towards, you know, the needs of the one becomes more important than the needs of the team. That's always a neat little story we like to see, where we see groups, you know, groups of friends show loyalty to protect one of their own. So those are the most common ways you can show a team functioning as one another, and as you see it in movies and TV. So the Motley Crue in particular, usually their objective is some evil Big Brother authority that they have to challenge and undermine and take down, or they have to protect innocent victims being persecuted or victimized by this authority. That's usually what they're doing. And you have to demonstrate that and demonstrate them kind of committing to that over their own self-interest. And you see that in some of the movies and TV shows I've mentioned here. And sometimes they inevitably move past that into a bigger cause. And sometimes that's what we see. And but not always. I mean, Pirates of the Caribbean and Godfather, they never went to a higher calling. No. So, yeah. I think I've about covered every base I wanted to cover here. I've definitely run long a little bit here right about... So that was my little spiel on Motley Crue. Just wanted to share that. It's kind of one of the things I've been thinking about a lot and watching the show, and just wanted to share some of the things I've learned. I post some email, some websites of other writers and other experts that have talked about this. So I'll post that and also a few other things. So yeah, just wanted to share that with everyone. And I'm actually right now working on a Motley Crue style series. So this has kind of been on my mind lately as well. But I will leave it at that. Go see Guardians of the Galaxy. If you haven't, go see Firefly. Go see most of the other movies I've mentioned. They're all great movies. But that will do it for this episode. Until next time.